I joined them, we were focused on much more traditional asset classes. Lines. They report up to me, but they don't report to each other at all, although they collaborate closely. And we do still try to give people as much freedom as possible. But this is not not where we were 3 years ago, for sure.
Token Arthur was always curious about new things. One day, while flying over the jungle, he saw a group of animals exchanging goods and services using colorful stones. So he contacted fintech CDOs from fantastic companies all around the world and collaborated with them to learn all about finance. Inspired, Arthur asked Insert CEO Vasil to help start a podcast to share their knowledge with the world. This is what you are watching right now, Fintech CDO Podcast. Enjoy.
So look, I have a couple questions to what you said, you know, specifically like fees, integrations, different regulations, liquidity, which is very important. So what about, like, what about fees? I mean, like, I think it was in the same press release, something like that, you know, given the entirely that you have on-chain nature and like you can provide the very low cost transactions fees. So why and how you can do this? Because you need to run through all these conversions. So,
yeah, that's a very good question. It doesn't really make sense on the surface, right? So there are a couple fees that we can't avoid. The stablecoin providers may have certain banking related fees. So I'm a US citizen, I'm used to sending bank wires here in the US, and I'm used to getting charged a bank wire fee when I wire funds. And depending on your account, maybe you don't get charged wire fees, but in most cases, people do pay wire fees. And that wire fee, that's part of the traditional legacy banking system. I can't get you out of that wire fee. You're going to pay that when you wire funds out of your USD based bank account. And on the other side, there might be some fees related to the other banking system. And those are fees we can't get rid of. That's just the cost of doing business. But the FX conversion is usually very expensive. There's no reason it really needs to be. What's happening is that the industry is structured in tiers. And you have your interbank market where the transaction costs to perform a conversion are extremely low, lower than you could possibly imagine. We talk about basis points in the crypto industry. We talk about something called pips and points in the FX industry that are another two or three decimals past that. These are very, very small fees. The difference between the euro dollar bid and ask, you know, the main transaction cost that you pay when you perform a conversion under a institutional structured trading relationship, that's going to be generally somewhere between 1 and 3, so you're going to be 5 decimal points out. So it might be, you know, 0.00001 versus 0.00003. Like that's the spread. You've got 2 as your spread there, that far out. So that fee should be very low, but that's the interbank market. Then in order to transact in that market, you need a prime brokerage relationship. And PB relationships are going to have minimum deposit levels in FX that usually start around 20 mil. And then if you want to operate without being able to get your own direct PB line, then you need to find someone who has a PB line, have them carve out a piece of it, give it to you. They're going to put a fee structure on top of that. And now you're operating at the interbank transaction fees and then whatever your service provider is charging you for the PB line that they're allocating to you. And then if they're providing you some sort of leverage, there might be additional financing charges on top of that. So, you know, all of these fees, and we just looked at the top two layers, all of these fees, when you get down to like MoneyGram, allowing you to walk into somewhere and just put cash down and it goes out in a different currency, they charge, you're absorbing so many fees. There's so many rent seekers in the system that the fees just pile up to be these crazy, crazy levels. When you start moving towards smart contract-based systems and you're eliminating many of the layers of intermediaries most of those fees evaporate. And now you can start to see what's really happening. On chain, you see exactly what prices the transactions were converted at. The only real participants in the system are the stablecoin provider and the marketplace where the actual liquidity is coming from. And yes, at that point, you need someone who's operating at a level of scale, such as Shift Markets or other market makers. You know, we encourage any market makers to join the system. We are not looking to create some sort of walled garden where we're extracting as much value from the system as possible. These are open protocols. We want everyone participating. The more liquidity, the better, including retail customers. If you want to come in and say, I'm willing to do this conversion at this particular rate, as long as you're the best rate, you should be able to win the flow. So, you know, it's this creation of an open marketplace that is open to the retail level that never could have existed because of the legacy structure of a marketplace that developed over the course of 100 years. You know, originally the euro and the dollar were the original trading pair that was a heavily traded international pair over an undersea cable, and the pair was known as the cable. So we're calling our marketplace technology cables.finance is the website. It's called Cables. And that's a homage to the original FX trading pair and how far back it goes. So, you know, over the years, there's just been a lot of cruft that's developed, and it's been accepted that these are the costs that people should pay and that it's okay that there's all these rent seekers in the system. And, you know, they've built a system that works, and maybe it is okay that that system works that way. But we're building a new system. It works a little differently, and it has a lot lower cost structure associated with it.
So, look, I had a conversation recently with CTO of Fiat Republic, Martina, and also with Yeshu from a CTO of Transact. And look, they also say that they are bridging the world, you know, of traditional finance with the crypto. And it looks like there are many companies and the many platforms on the market that they're trying to build actually this kind of bridge between like fiat and crypto, traditional payments on chain. And so how do you see in this situation? So, like, are you breaching in some other way? So do you provide some other solution, or is it like a competition here, or is it more like a cooperation here? So what's the situation? How do you see it?
So every day I hear about someone doing something that has similarities to what we're doing. Sometimes it's very similar. Sometimes it's, you know, it has its own flavor on it. And I'm honestly not worried about it. We're in a period where it's very, very early days. And I hope that everyone's able to get a lot of customers and grow the overall market very quickly. And then, yeah, at some point we might start entering more direct competition. But at this point, there's so many ways that people are differentiated. What stablecoins are you supporting? What blockchains are you supporting? How are you actually reaching customers and getting them to learn about your product in this, you know, more niche space that we're not advertising at the Super Bowl, you know, like this is not that type of product yet. So we find that the partnerships are very effective, and we try to build these open protocols that allow for very productive partnerships. You mentioned the stablecoins partnership, but if you search for Press on Shift, it'll almost always be a partnership. It's rare that we're announcing something that just we do that isn't in collaboration with others, because that's not really the DNA of our company. We love to find ways to work with another company to build something that is better than either of us could provide. And, you know, these companies that are providing similar sorts of products, maybe there's great opportunities for us to collaborate, or, you know, maybe they're doing something even better than we are, but I feel really confident in our team's ability to see the most recent developments in the blockchain space, to see the upcoming opportunities. You know, we have products that are designed that we can't really implement yet because some of the cross blockchain communication channels aren't quite where we need them to be, but We see the development of some of the ZK-based solutions that are going to allow us to do what we want to do. So we have all the sequence diagrams and all the flow charts for how the product will work, but it's not yet time to implement it. And if we did, the user base on those blockchains is so small and the trust in them, like they also need to be put to the test. We have to see them operate at scale for some period of time. And you know, a scale means financial scale. Like it doesn't matter that you've done 10,000 transactions. If each one is worth a quarter of a cent, doesn't matter. I can't trust that system yet. So, you know, I think we're going to be releasing products that are better than what most of our competitors are doing, but I'd rather think of them more as potential partners and find ways to work together.
But where do you see the competition happening more? Who is able to attract more liquidity partners, or who is able to do more integrations, you know, with traditional financial institutions and also with different cryptocurrencies, so we're able to negotiate better maybe fees. Or maybe marketing, like able to attract end users. So where is the biggest competition is happening?
So I think everyone views the most important area to compete a little differently. Our business has always been B2B. So we do see a lot of people going B2C, and then marketing is the big deal for them. And they're trying to attract those end users. And for them, it might be how many wallets, different wallet technologies are they integrated with? And, you know, and where can they get press and maybe get integrated into other platforms that are like portfolio management platforms that can, like certain custodial solutions, for example, during the big DeFi push around maybe early last summer or like a year and a half ago, basically, we started to see some of the lending pools get directly integrated into custodial solutions. So you could, without having to pull it out to a DeFi wallet and then drop it in via Web3, you could go directly from your custodial solution into the lending pool. That is really powerful for that DeFi lending pool. And it did see them increase their TVL quite a bit. But realistically, that's a B2B relationship. And a custodian is only going to be used by someone operating at a certain level of scale. You don't see end users opening Fireblocks accounts. That's not something they do. The cost structure wouldn't make any sense. So we have always been B2B. So for us, the way that we try to compete is by finding companies that want to do something bigger than what they're able to achieve today, saying, oh, we have the pieces that you don't have. And we also potentially have the partnerships that you might need in addition to what we have to do the whole thing. So, you know, I mentioned the fiat to fiat, and that's the dream there. And that's what Stablecoins wants to do. So they're partnering with us, and we have relationships with other stablecoin providers to do that fiat to fiat. But from our point of view, it would be great if people didn't want to use fiat anymore. Let's just stick to the stablecoin. So we use that for the on-ramp, and on the off-ramp, we'll just send the stablecoin out. Now, you know, the fiat ramp goes away and we don't really need that. But that's what got stablecoins excited about working with us, because we can provide that end-to-end solution that they're looking for. We have the marketplace, we have the liquidity that's coming direct from us, and then we have the partnerships with other companies similar to them for the end-to-end experience that they want to provide. So that's really a great microcosm, a really representative example of how we approach the competitive marketplace. And that's where we focus on expanding our business, and we found it to be successful, not just in crypto, like across the board over the last 10 years. While I've been here, that's been our most successful path towards growth.
Yeah, but anyway, I think it's great that you can also have your own liquidity, and probably it helps a lot.
Yeah, that does help a lot.
Yeah.
So it's important to have your own products. You got to have your own stuff, and they have to be good. Yes. You got to be able to do what you do better than anyone else. And then the partnerships can be these force multipliers.
So look, traditional custodials actually are like were good for the KYC okay? And we had some issues in the crypto space, like with know your client processes. So what do you provide out of the box for your on your platform, actually, as a part of your platform for KYC, actually?
So KYC, we do have in-house built KYC product for people that are more, for companies that are more entry level and have a more limited budget. So we can provide you a KYC solution where the end users are uploading documents into an encrypted S3 bucket and your admin team has a permission back office with different levels of permission for what they're able to modify versus view to review the documents and move users between different KYC levels. Very few customers use it. We primarily focus on integrating with KYC providers. Sum and Substance might be the most popular these days. They provide a pretty clean solution, and it's most likely our most recommended vendor in that space today. But also many of the custodians will carry their own KYC requirements. And if that's the case, you can do a multi-KYC integration if you want, but many times you can just leverage your custodian's KYC review as your own KYC review. If the person who actually has to hold the money is comfortable with this customer, then I'm comfortable with the customer. So then you just start paying for custodial services and you're piggybacking off the free KYC that comes with it. So many times that's the way it works, especially if you're in a more regulated environment, which is when you tend to have more focus on the KYC process itself. If you're in that regulated environment, you may need to work with custodians that adhere to certain regulatory controls and reporting requirements. So now you're restricted to a very small number of custodians. And sometimes those custodians are using more standard industry players behind the scenes, and they may or may not disclose that. We usually know that, so we can tell our customer, like, okay, yeah, you're working with this regulated custodian, but don't worry, it's this industry best practice technology provider behind the scenes. You're just going through like a little proxy API there. So they can trust the security of this best practice player in the space and get the regulatory cover that they need from this regulated custodian. And then the regulated custodian is also going to have KYC requirements that are compliant with the local governance. And then you just piggyback off of that. So, you know, it gets complicated. Like, you got to deal with government rules, you know?
Yeah, certainly. So, okay. Look, so actually decentralized exchange is like more obvious platform, like a core platform that you have. But you have also like less obvious to myself, actually, features, let's say, like yield farming and also NFT marketplace. And also you have a DAO, which is decentralized autonomous organization feature. So among these, among this feature, so what is most used, you know, what is really used in on the scale, or what could you tell us here?
So definitely in terms of scale, the centralized technology is what we're seeing the largest adoption of right now. The decentralized technology is still in its infancy, and that's what we're pushing. So the partnership that you spoke about earlier, that's the decentralized technology at work. And that's where we're investing very heavily. And the products that you just outlined, our NFT marketplace, the yield farming is actually a little more centralized. It has integrations with decentralized venues, but we're not actually providing a decentralized yield farming venue ourselves. So we haven't published an AMM or something like that. We've integrated with these different pools, and we provide a layer in between. So if you're a company that wants to give your customers a way to get yield on their crypto that they're holding on deposit with you, it provides a layer where
more
you can
like
pull
a connection,
the rates.
Connection to other farms. Okay.
Exactly. Cool. Connection, cool. The ability to mark down the interest rate when someone puts funds in, how long is it before they start to earn interest? You know, normally it would be the first block when you deposit, right? But if you're a corporation that has a bunch of funds on deposit, you want to be able to sweep the funds over to the yield farming pool in one transaction. So you're not paying, you know, $150 every time you get a small little deposit into the yield farming. And then you also don't have to pass those costs along to your customer. So they get an advantage too. It can be very expensive to get small amounts of funds in and out of these lending pools. But when you're working with a larger corporation who's handling these in bulk, they'll do a once a day true up across the two platforms. They don't have to pass those costs along to you, but it does mean that maybe you don't start earning interest until midnight or something like that. And they're probably taking a little piece of the interest too.
Yeah, so, that's clear.
Yeah. So cool. Like that's what the yield farming product is there. And it's integrated with our other product offerings. So if you're using an exchange from Shift, you can offer yield generation alongside it, and you can have multiple decentralized venues available, or you can have your own managed funds programs that you're offering natively. And you can also have the additional, like maybe you've got your own loyalty token. You can issue that on top of rewards in kind. So you deposit Ethereum, you're going to earn Ethereum back, but you're also going to get loyalty token on top of that, you know, your traditional yield farming model. But back to the original question of what's popular. The trading tech is definitely the most popular part. And we see it in a lot of different flavors. I mentioned there's payment processors, there's point of sale solutions, there's people that are using it for internal tracking purposes, there's your fully public exchange, there's the firm quote. So we have an RFQ product that lives on top of the exchange, watches the real-time order book, and provides rate locked quotes. And there's different risk management controls on that. We also have market making products. So because we do so much market making, we have built a robust set of tools around market making. And sometimes our customers want to take much more control over how liquidity is provided either to themselves or where they're operating their business. They need the tools to do something more robust than what they're able to do today. So that stack can be very useful, especially because of our FX liquidity. We can help you take a Bitcoin dollar order book and convert it into a Bitcoin Indian rupee order book or whatever foreign fiat you might need. So if you're operating in India, now you can consume aggregated liquidity, converted in real time to Indian rupee. And when a trade comes out, you can hedge out the dollar rupee risk and hedge out the crypto risk, whatever, against USD as two separate legs. And then, you know, the way those hedge also operate differently, because the FX market is usually a pure maker taker, where you're either a taker and you're receiving a price stream, and then you put in a trade request and you might get slipped on the execution. It's not a true exchange, versus the crypto, where you're going to get charged a lower commission if you're the maker, you're pricing into a true exchange with an order book. So, you know, the technology is doing a lot behind the scenes. So these are the technologies that we're seeing the largest adoption of today. But where we see the big opportunity is in the Web3 space, in the on-chain execution, in the decentralized marketplace. So that's where we're investing.
Yeah, but what exactly? Like, because like NFT markets, like, for example, NFT markets, so how big is the NFT market scene? So how many NFT markets have you launched? And like, who are they? And also maybe what about like DAO? Yeah. So it's very interesting feature. Yeah. Like to run purely like virtual organizations again. So do you have that kind of organizations who uses your platform? So who are they? I mean, like maybe not by the names, but what types of organizations uses NFT markets? What types of organizations uses DAO platform? Just interesting.
Yeah. So that's a great question. What is the real like showstopper product in this Web3 world? Where is the real demand? And the truth is, these are new product offerings for us that went live over the last year. So you're talking about things that might only be 3-4 months old at this point. We haven't had an opportunity to have that many customers on board, and we don't really know where the opportunity is going to be. This is the most exploratory we've ever gotten. We've always been much more conservative Up until this year, we never raised outside capital. We always focused on the company was fully bootstrapped and we needed to be profitable basically every month or we were going to have a problem. But now we want to invest in these bigger opportunities. There's too many opportunities. They're so large that if we just let them pass us by, that's the mistake. So we've started, you know, allowing outside investors to inject some capital so that we can start to pursue more opportunities than we otherwise would allow ourselves to pursue. And I don't know exactly what is going to be super popular. So the NFT marketplace, I think we've got maybe four of them that have gone live so far. They're all in their very early stages. We're talking to a very large company right now who wants to incorporate it into their loyalty program. So it's a name that everyone would know if I said it, but of course I can't. But what they want to do is use the marketplace not as a marketplace, just as a ledger and issuance platform so that they can create the NFTs on demand in response to someone reaching certain spending thresholds and reaching certain loyalty thresholds, create it, issue it through the platform, allow custodianship to be handled either through an enterprise custodian, which now the enterprise custodians are providing custody services for NFTs as well, which traditionally they only did fungible tokens. So it's exciting to see them expanding in that way as well. So either the company can hold the NFT on behalf of the customer, or it can be transferred out to the customer's own custodianship if they want. And these are all features of the platform. Normally, people are buying them through the platform, but that's not happening in this case. But that's okay. You know, they're using all the other features and then a couple extra features they need added that are related to, of course, like we always have to do single sign-on integration so that you can support the customers of the company if it's an existing company that's adding the product offering. In this case, they want to do dynamic art generation. And then they also need to store that art either in a more traditional Web2 way or an IPFS. So we're talking about exactly how the art should be generated and stored. It looks like they'll be working with local artists in different cities and commissioning generative art pieces from these different localities and then issuing local art pieces. So it's not just what thresholds did you reach, but also who are you for what type of NFT you'll be receiving. So, you know, this is a very exciting use case that I never would have envisioned if we had this conversation 3 weeks ago. It's a crazy space. I love seeing where it goes. And it is tough to predict, though, you know, what next week holds.
I think you mentioned very important topic here and about being bootstrapped company versus being the capital injected company, let's say. Because right now I'm talking to many different fintech companies and it looks like the companies who actually rely on the like the outside investment, outside capital, they're doing not so good in this environment, okay? Because, you know, private equities and venture capital, they're just cutting all the checks off and but the companies who actually rely on their cash flows, they are doing much better than somebody who is owned by the venture capital or private capital, you know. So that's why, I mean, I think it's a very smart move not to inject the capital at some point of time, at least in this kind of environment.
I think there's a couple driving factors behind that. One is that a lot of the capital that was flowing to crypto companies was coming from foundations of particular tokens, and their funds were denominated in that token. And when you see a rapid depreciation of many of those tokens, it's maybe you were a fund that had $1 billion and now your fund only has $200 million. That's going to really impact not just the investments that were in your pipeline, which may have been speaking to you for 6 months and were towards the end of their round, but also the investments you've made. Now you feel a lot more pressure to get a return on investment out of them. And the funds you invested that they might have been holding in that token have just dropped too. So you view it as having made a $50 million investment, but from their point of view, they only have $10 million. So you know, your return on investment is going to look like a return on 10 mil, not a return on 50 mil. And that's not, that doesn't align the interest very well between the people that made the investment and the people that are trying to execute with the funds that have been invested. So you've got a lot of very specific esoteric problems for the crypto industry. But then beyond that, yeah, a lot of the companies that are getting a big capital injection early on, they're only a couple years old. They were in this mentality where they don't have to drive profits. They can focus on the long term. And when the environment, some of the assumptions that they had around their runway drastically change, you see significant reductions in headcount. You see a major change in corporate strategy from a long-term vision to a very quickly put together short-term return that is maybe not going to materialize and is kind of a bet the whole company on this opportunity thing. And there, these companies that are operating on this funding model where they are pursuing this one long-term vision, they tend not to have the diversification either, where they developed different business lines. So even if crypto disappeared for us entirely, that would be bad. Without question, that would be bad. And we have a lot of people that work on crypto. So it might mean we'd have to reduce headcount because we can't do the things that those people do anymore. But the company would be fine. You know, we operate in many other asset classes. We have existing product lines. They're yielding profit. When one asset when one product line isn't doing so well, the other product lines, you know, lift the boat. You know, it's very helpful to be a more mature company. And you can get there through VC funding. There's no question you can get there through VC funding. But those first couple years, which in the crypto industry, everyone's in their first couple years, you know, those are precarious years. That's where things can really go wrong. And we're unfortunately seeing that happen to a lot of companies, which I don't like. You know, like I said before, I don't view them as competitors. Seeing a bunch of crypto companies go out of business is bad for me. It's not good for me. It doesn't give me more of this giant pie. It makes the pie small. Like, but you know,
yeah, I will agree with you here. So my very last question maybe here, as we speak, we are observing the decline of many different asset classes right now. Yeah, so like stock exchanges collapsing a little bit, and also cryptocurrencies, like major cryptocurrencies, they are declining, and different other tokens as well. So actually, markets are slowing down, the economy is slowing down a little bit, and we're observing many layoffs, including from different technology companies. So, you know, that said, so are you optimistic for the next year? When do you think the markets will start recovering? And actually, what are you going to do in that kind of environment?
So that's it's always tough to predict the future. Yes. Much better at predicting the past. But looking forward, I do see a lot of challenges facing the overall financial markets that are going to be difficult to overcome, especially with a lot of the international conflict that is currently occurring and appears to be in the early stages of occurring. We're seeing a breakdown of some of the globalization that we had seen develop over the last 20 to 30 years. It's always healthy to have international competition. It's not healthy to see large barriers to trade erected, entire cultures positioned in this adversarial way against each other. We're starting to see that between US and China, which disrupts a lot of global supply chains. And people used to look at crypto and also precious metals as hedges against the more traditional markets. So if you're invested in equities, maybe you could pick up some gold and silver to hedge against it. And if the equities go down, the gold's going to go up. That doesn't always work out so well in practice. And crypto has been the same way. A lot of people said, you know, if the market's crashing, Bitcoin's going to go to the sky. Like, not so much. When when the equity market is crashing, you'll tend to see people liquidate their newest investments and the assets that they consider to be the riskiest investments. So crypto is actually one of the first things to get sold. So a drop in the equities market usually means a drop in the crypto market. There tends to be a very high correlative factor between major markets and crypto and alternative asset classes in general. So unfortunately, I wish I had great news about where I see all this optimistic opportunity. What I do see is that crypto is still a very young asset class that is missing regulation that it needs. And with the collapse of FTX and Alameda and the contagion that it's brought, I think we're going to start to see some of this badly needed regulation. And that will start to, A, mean that there's actual legitimate safety there. There's, you can be confident that the companies you're working with are doing what they're telling you they're doing. But secondly, it will mean that we'll be able to create, the financial markets in general will be able to create derivatives off of these that are more traditional derivatives. You'll be able to see fixed income derivatives be created. They'll go through the traditional rating process. You'll start to see the AAA rated fixed income derivatives off of crypto assets. And of course, you could end up with a 2008 housing market kind of situation. And you eventually will, right? You'll get those crazy over financial engineering. But that will mean that pension funds can now make an allocation to this asset class. And, you know, maybe they're just making a 0.5% allocation to the crypto asset class as a whole. And they're doing it through these fixed income derivatives. Okay, if you're a $2 trillion pension fund, that 0.5% allocation is going to move the market. That's not a small injection of capital when you look at the average daily trading volume of the markets. It doesn't matter what the market cap is. What matters is how much is trading liquidly on a daily basis, because that trade is a block that needs to get executed. It needs to get executed fairly quickly. So I do see there being a long-term, very strong, positive, bullish focus for the crypto market. But in the short term, it is going to be correlated to the other major markets. There are a lot of geopolitical factors that are driving the downward movement of major markets, and crypto will not be immune to it, nor will any other market. And all we can hope for is that there's new innovations. We have AI coming and doing some really exciting stuff over the last year. We've seen the AI generation. GPT-3 has now been released publicly as ChatGPT or GPT Chat. I forget which way they put. But these are technologies that can start to really change the productivity landscape. We're starting to see artists whose focus is on understanding which of these AI gen platforms will produce the type of result that their customer is looking for. You're looking for something hyper realistic. Okay, maybe I'm selecting this particular platform and I'm adding these 20 keywords to the end of it. The prompts that they're putting together look nothing like what you or I would type into this platform. And they understand the difference between DALL-E and Midjourney and Stable Diffusion and all the other platforms. This is a real job, an emerging new class of jobs that is going to be working with these AIs that has an insane productivity boost. It doesn't necessarily do exactly what the previous generation, but maybe if you had five artists on your team, you could keep one to do the hand refinement of what's being generated by the AI, and four could be replaced by one who is an AI art gen expert. And that guy's going to be more expensive than any one of the four that you are removing, but not as expensive as all four put together. For sure. And together between him and the hand artist, you might be able to produce a much higher level of output than you were ever able to achieve with the five you had before. And that's just the art gen that we saw this year. Where is AI going from here? Like, I don't know. So all I can hope is that these productivity increases yield significant growth in GDP and overall economic development that are able to overpower some of the geopolitical factors like war and trade barriers that are being constructed that are constraining the global economy. But, you know, now we're getting into like very speculative financial market space.
Yeah, look, Tony, so I see that you have a very good big picture view and the strategy here and the company, and you stand pretty strong in that kind of market and environment. So I really like it, and it was really super cool to have this deep conversation with you today.
It's a pleasure to catch back up and to come back. And I hope that I can return again in the future, because I always enjoy speaking to you, and it's an insightful conversation from my side too. There's a couple things that we spoke about that I'll definitely be going back to my team to talk a bit further about. And you know, I'm looking forward to the next time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And to everyone who is watching us, so please add your 5 cents in the comments below. And what do you think about the major trends in crypto, and especially about this topic of bridging the centralized and the decentralized financial worlds? And do not forget to like this video and to subscribe to our channel. And again, it was Anthony DeSanti from Shift Markets. And it was me, Vasil Salashuk, from Insart. And thank you for watching this podcast. So be healthy, stay well, and see you in the next episode of our FinTech CTO podcast. Bye-bye.
Still watching us and have not subscribed yet? Let's fix this. Also, don't forget to like this video and take a look at the other episodes we have. See ya.